Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there.
Iran attacks Israel, Donald Trump on trial, and the annual insult that is tax day. All this and more on today's episode of The Editors. I'm Noah Rothman. Rich is out today, but in his absence, we're joined by, you know him as the Sage of Authenticity Woods. I know him as senior political correspondent Jim Garrity, the Thomas L. Rhodes Fellow at National Review Institute, the Dominator, Dominic Pino, and our fearless leader, the editor of National Review Online, Phil Klein. You're, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. Our sponsors this episode are Patriot Voices and Made In. More on them a little later on. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. If you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing 5-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So by the end of last week, we had a lot of indications that Iran was going to pull the trigger on a military response against Israel, as what it said would be a reprisal for Israel's strike on what Iran claims was a diplomatic consulate in Syria, in which two Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps figures were killed. We should say at the outset that Israel's strike inside Syria was itself retaliatory, a response to an Iran-directed campaign of violence against Israel that began on October 7th and has continued ever since. It's been under attack from Iranian proxies, including Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, the Shiite militias in Iraq and Syria, and now the Iranian regime proper. One of the IRGC targets that was taken out in that strike, Mohammad Reza Zahidi, was implicated in the planning of the October 7th massacre. If you haven't heard about that from media coverage of these attacks, ask yourself, why? Iran retailed its intention to strike Israel directly from its territory, and that's what we got. Saturday night, U.S. time, Iran lobbed a volley of ballistic missiles and suicide drones. Fortunately, just about all of them were intercepted by Israel's layered air defense and its allies and partners, including the United States and even some Middle Eastern countries. But I don't think anybody should doubt that a 300-plus drone and missile strike, some of which did penetrate Israeli airspace, was anything other than an attempt to overwhelm Israeli air defenses. So, Phil, in the immediate aftermath of this attack, a lot of the usual suspects for whom Israel's response to attacks is always more terrible than the attacks itself, were beginning to get a little squeamish. And I think it's pretty pathological, but nevertheless, the U.S. government, the British government, a lot of Israel's partners were saying, listen, you got to stand down. And as of Saturday night, based on any rational interpretation of the laws of war, a state of war now exists between Israel and the Islamic Republic. Israel cannot afford to stand down. No?
No. I mean, this was an unprecedented attack. Iran never has attacked Israel directly from its territory. Typically, it will tell Hezbollah or Hamas to fire some rockets at Israel. But this was an unprecedented escalation. A lot of people are trying to play it down just because the U.S. and Israel and allied response was incredible to be able to knock down almost all of the incoming missiles and drones. But when you send over 100 ballistic missiles toward another nation's capital, that shouldn't be seen as sort of non-threatening just because of the Merak. I mean, it threatened Israel for days. They were on edge. The people had to worry about Iran attack. Schools were closed. I mean, it disrupted a whole society. The airspace was shut down. So it does have real effects. And at any point, those could want something could come through. And let us not forget that this is all in the context of Iran seeking nuclear weapons, pledging to destroy Israel and wipe it off the map. And if those were ballistic missiles were armed with nuclear warheads and one of them got through, it would have devastating consequences on Israel. So Israel cannot allow this escalation to go without a dramatically different response. They can't just, you know, knock off a few Iranian proxy targets in Syria or Lebanon. They have to directly go after the head of the beast. Doesn't necessarily mean that they have to, you know, go all out and declare, you know, full on nonstop war with Iran, but they have to do something that's dramatically different, that's equivalent to the fact that Iran did something dramatically different. And it's egregious that Israel is being pressured to not respond or to respond mildly. And let us not forget that we wouldn't be in this shape were it not for Obama-Biden policies, which, not to relitigate everything point by point, or we'd be here for an hour, but the Obama and Biden had a strategy that we can't antagonize Iran at all. And if we do so, then it's going to embolden the extremists. And if we engage with Iran, it's going to help bring out the moderate forces. But Iran senses weakness. It senses the fact that Biden has abandoned Israel and is increasingly amping up the criticism of Israel, and that its support for Israel has a limit to it. And so Iran saw that as a green light to escalate. And if Biden successfully pressures Israel into not responding, the Iranian calculation would have been proven right, and they'll probably do something even worse next time.
Yeah, we keep hearing about proportionality. We heard about proportionate, must got to be a proportionate response after October 7th, as though anything resembling a proportionate response to that massacre would have been, you know, something other than a crime against humanity. And if Israel were to mount a proportional response to this attack, 300 drones and missiles raining down on civilian targets in Iran, it would be an absolute nightmare for Israel in the PR space. Every country on earth would be up in arms over how disproportionate that directly proportional response would be. Jim, there's good, bad, and ugly here. The good, Phil mentioned, it's kind of this unprecedented, overt, owned response to this attack from places like Jordan and Saudi Arabia that were engaged actively in the defense of Israeli territory. You couldn't even imagine anything like that 20 years ago. But the bad and the ugly are that obviously this was, in my view, an attempt to overwhelm Israeli air defenses. And some of those ballistic missiles did penetrate Israeli airspace, as I said before. So according to reports, Joe Biden has reportedly told Benjamin Netanyahu to, quote, take the win, as though Israel wasn't on the back foot here. There seems to be some confusion over it, why Israel would respond at all, as though any other nation on earth would just absorb this kind of attack. No one would. It was executed by a sovereign military. It was claimed by a hostile regime. What are we talking about here other than the existence of a state of war between Tehran and Jerusalem?
Yeah, I don't think you can dispute that Israel dodged a bullet here. And because they dodged that metaphorical bullet, I think a lot of people want to pretend as if the shooting did not occur. I've been thinking a lot about this, about how previous times we've had near misses, where things, bad, violent things happened, but they could have been much, much worse. When that nut job Bernie Sanders fan shot up the baseball field with Republican congressmen. Thank God Steve Scalise survived, and there was, I believe, a member of the congressional, a member of Capitol Police hurt. But, you know, it would not have taken much different for, God forbid, that nut job to have killed, you know, anywhere from a handful to a whole bunch of Republican congressmen. And that would have been awful. That would have been, you know, God, thank God that didn't happen. But if it had happened, maybe the course of our public politics might have changed a little bit. Maybe people might have been a little quicker to recognize that all of this incendiary and angry and ever more furious rhetoric can have some consequences, and then maybe it would have lowered the temperature in our public discourse. January 6th, was bad enough as is. But if you could very easily imagine a scenario where the angry mob gets their hands on Vice President Mike Pence or members of Congress, and there could have been significant numbers of deaths. Thank God that didn't happen. But if it had turned out differently, maybe the consequences for January 6th would have been different, and maybe these sorts of things would have gotten us to pull back from the abyss. It's kind of absurd that Iran and its proxies can launch 300 cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, and drones. And as of this last I heard, the only injury was that poor little girl, the Dawan girl out in the middle of the desert. There's some minor damage to some Israeli airbase. But to have that 300 things get launched at you and that little gets hurt and that little gets damaged, that's like near miraculous. But the problem is that when you dodge the bullet, when you have that much better, remarkably good outcome, it makes it easier for people to forget. It makes it easier for people to decide, oh, this wasn't that big a deal. We don't need, there's no need for Israel to respond as if Iran had just launched 300, missiles and drones at it because so few got through and the consequences were so minimal. In other words, Iran really got saved by Israel's air defense and the efforts of the US and the UK and the Jordanians and the Saudis. So all of this is just kind of maddening in that everything that happens always seems to come out as okay, Israel, you've done enough. It's time for you to take the win. God forbid, by the way, the Iron Dome system is like an amazing system. 90% it stops, which is great. If you got 10 missiles coming at you, and only one gets through, that's great. But that still means one gets through. The idea that you could reach that anyone would kind of hand wave this away and now say, okay, you're even. It's time for everybody to calm down. Look, we have a president who just desperately wants the world to calm down between now and November. Doesn't want to deal with it. Didn't want to have to come back from Delaware. Think about it. Friday, he's before the National Action Network, Al Sharpton's old crew. And he says, it's going to come sooner rather than later. Mr. President, what's your message for them? Don't. Yes, the same don't that didn't deter Vladimir Putin, the same don't that didn't deter the Houthis, the same don't that didn't deter attacks on U.S. and the Middle East earlier this year. Same old message. And then he goes to Rehoboth Beach. Really? Is this the time to go enjoy your beach house, Mr. President? So look, this is an administration that is just short of checked out. It just wants to... the last thing it wants is another fight that's going badly overseas. The last thing it wants is another headache that upsets the American people. It just wants everybody to quiet down and go away. And unfortunately, the rest of the world will not just let our tired old president enjoy his quiet weekend in Delaware.
Yeah, Dominic, to Jim's point there, there's everywhere you look in the press, with the exception of Semaphore, which quoted one senior American official as saying the attack was intended to culminate in, quote, mass casualties and infrastructure damage. The experts that media figures are talking to, almost all of them seem to believe that this was like Steve Urkel style designed to fail. I meant to do that. That Israel, or Iran rather, wanted to launch all this ordnance that's not entirely replaceable in necessarily a short period, and have it all intercepted and be humiliated on the world stage. That's what it wanted. That's why it was telegraphing this response in days in advance. It was just a face-saving maneuver. The problem with that is we know what a face-saving maneuver looks like from the Iranian military. We saw it in January of 2020 in the wake of the Soleimani strike, in which Iran did do something rather provocative by launching ballistic missiles from its territory towards targets inside Iraq. A grand total of 12 ballistic missiles. This was orders of magnitude greater. The Biden administration, obviously, as Jim says, wants to de-escalate, de-conflict, just not be bothered. But Iran's intention seems to me to have been escalatory. I can't see any other design behind this attack, whether the Biden administration wants to admit it or not. Will they ever admit it?
No, they won't admit it because their agenda has been to pursue piece for its own sake with no nothing to back it up. And we've seen the consequences of that now, because believe it or not, Iran is not a friendly country run by people who want to get along with the international community. This is a country run by terrorists supporting fanatics who will do whatever they think is the right thing to do for their perverted aims. I think it's worth mentioning here how this illustrates how the success of Israel's response to this, or Israel's defense against it, I should say, illustrates the importance of cooperation between allies, because the Iron Dome system, the David Sling system, the Arrow system, and those last two were more used for these ballistic missiles that were coming in. You know, Iron Dome is usually for shorter range missiles from groups like Hamas. These were all developed between the United States and Israel. They were developed with Israeli companies doing a lot of the technical work, with American money financing it, but also working together with American defense contractors as well. And now we see, for example, the David Sling system, which has been just proven to be extremely effective. Last year, brand new NATO member Finland announced that it was going to be purchasing some of those weapons or defense systems for itself. And so we see this cooperation across borders that allows us to better defend ourselves and our allies against threats from enemy countries. And then you look at a country like Iran, which, you know, who are their allies? Well, it's none of the rich countries of the world. It's places like China. It's places like Russia, places like North Korea. This came up just a couple days ago when the Prime Minister of Japan came and spoke in the United States. He spoke to Congress and he talked about how important it was for the U.S. to be in the free world. He said, America needs the free world and the free world needs America. The exact same day that he was coming and doing that, you know, one of the world's largest economies with brands and pop culture recognized around the world. This is an extremely powerful, wealthy country that the United States has a very, very good relationship with. On that same day, China announced that it was strengthening its ties with North Korea. Now, again, which side would you rather be on in this conflict? The side that can work with a country like Japan, side that can work with a country like Israel, or the side that really thinks that there's something beneficial in being best buddies with one of the poorest countries on the planet? I think this really shows the asymmetry that we have and the advantage that we have in the free world. But we still have to choose to take advantage of take advantage of our advantages is what I was going to say, but that doesn't really work, does it? But we have to, right? Because our enemies aren't going to stop. Iran has demonstrated this over and over again, whether it's with the Houthis in Yemen attacking international shipping, which they're still doing, by the way, whether you're looking at the various missile attacks that they've launched on U.S. facilities all across the Middle East since October 7th as well. We have to remind ourselves that we actually do have the upper hand here. There is not a reason for us to be cowering in fear over the threat of Iran. We just need to take advantage of that as wise policymakers.
Absolutely. It should be the other way around. This anti-American coalition should be afraid of Western escalation, or at least have some pause in their efforts to goad us into conflict. So, exit question for you guys, now that the shadow conflict is out in the open and could very well get worse. As of this recording, 10:27 a.m. on the East Coast, Israel has not yet retaliated against Iran. Question is, will Israel retaliate against Iran directly, as in its on targets in its territory, and disproportionately? Yes or no, Jim?
Well, the first answer is yes, and disproportionate, well, it's all in the eye of beholder. I would not expect Israel's response to be light or slow. Or, it will carry on for a while.
Phil?
I would say yes, that Israel is going to have orchestrate a strike on Iranian military targets inside Iran, but it will be calibrated in a way that they hope won't lead to another escalation and thereby further anger the Biden administration.
Dominic.
Yeah, I agree with Phil and Jim on that. I think they have to. They were clearly attacked, and they would be irresponsible to do nothing. And I don't think Israel is run by irresponsible people.
I'm torn on this because I would expect to see some preparation in the information space ahead of a really significant strike. And all we've seen so far, as I've seen, is from NBC News retailing the notion that Israel will retaliate against proxy forces, which would not be sufficient because I don't think Israel is going to be engaged in an insufficient response. I don't think that report is correct, but I'm not sure. Nevertheless, I will say yes for now. With that, let's turn to a message from our first sponsor today, Patriot Voices. Here's a simple thought. Parents matter. After all, who knows what's better for children, their parents or bureaucrats? Do you know what's best for your child, or do bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. have your child's best interests at heart? The answer is obvious. Parents matter. Right now, Congress is advancing a bill called the Kids Online Safety Act. This bill would strip parents of their decision-making authority if bureaucrats in the Federal Trade Commission decide that a Christian video or homeschooling site is dangerous or unscientific. Your family won't be able to access that material on the internet. Kids will be banned from seeing content online that the government deems dangerous. But the government's definition of what poses a threat to your child very likely is not your definition. If you believe parents matter, join Patriot Voices in opposing this takeover of parents' authority. Go to patriotvoices.com for more information and to take action. Again, that's patriotvoices.com because parents matter. So Monday, the very first trial of an ex-president in a criminal case began. Possibly the first of many, but what increasingly looks now like the only allegation against Donald Trump that'll see the inside of a courtroom before the votes are cast in November. This is the Alvin Bragg case, commonly euphemized as the porn star hush money case. But to summarize, just as a refresher, Alvin Bragg performed some jurisdictional prestidigitation to prosecute what would have been a misdemeanor charge of falsifying business records as a felony, so long as prosecutors can prove specific intent to commit or conceal another crime. And that crime could be a federal violation of election law or even state-level tax law. So Bragg alleges that Trump sought to hide violations or his business records in order to further this conspiracy, and it involves these hush money payments to Stormy Daniels, the theory being that had this payment been public, it might have altered the trajectory of the election. It's kind of convoluted. So for the first day, there weren't a lot of fireworks at the trial. We're in the process of jury selection, and Trump himself appeared to nod off during proceedings, which anyone can sympathize with. I certainly
can. Fake snooze.
Fake snooze. I was reading the line by line from the New York Times, and it was all rather dry. So I sympathize with him, but it won't stay sleepy for long. So Jim, the polling around this is interesting, and you wrote about it in today's Morning Jolt. I'm going to set the table a little bit, and you can take a big forearm and swipe all the plateware off of it. So back in December, I was perusing the polls, and it looked to me like there were two contradictory notions that were really, you know, taking hold among the electorate. One, that Donald Trump was the victim of a political prosecution, or persecution, rather. The Justice Department was out to get him. And two, that whatever he was accused of, he probably did. These two contradictory thoughts exist in the same head. But if you look at polling today, assuming voters are not rationalizing themselves into a position or responding to social desirability biases, a lot of voters, including a lot of independents and even many Republicans, up to a third of Republicans, depending on the poll, say if he was convicted of a felony, they'd have a hard time pulling the lever for him. It seems they're persuadable in one direction or the other, and that means the stakes are pretty big for this case, but you don't agree with my assessment.
Yeah, to become the Will Ferrell meme. I don't believe you. When people say that look, I am fully on board the Trump train. I think we need to put him back in power. But whoa. Not if he falsified business records to hide the payments to his porn star mistress. If he did that, that's a bridge too far. I just can't vote for the guy. We all know he had a shady reputation. And it's not banging the porn star that's the problem. It's not Melania being pregnant at the time that's the problem. It's the falsification of the business records. That's where I really just can't, I just can't abide that in a president. I'm sorry. I have a very hard time believing that that is actually the thinking of anybody out there. I understand the gut instinct of, oh, convicted felon. Well, we've never had one of those before. I couldn't vote for somebody like that. That'd be bad. But conviction, no. But will they is very different question from should they. And everything you wrote in your piece there, Noah, like it's logical, it's clear. You link to the polls. Everything's appealing to my noggin. But my gut is like, everybody knows what they think of this guy. We have not only have the first presidential rematch since 1956 or something. You know, Biden's been in the Senate since the 70s. Trump's been a celebrity since the 80s. He's been involved in 4,000 court cases over the course of his career. Everybody knows what they think of these guys. And I have a very hard time believing. Well, it turns out a jury in Manhattan found that Trump did indeed falsify business records to make those payments to his porn star mistress. I just have a hard time believing people are like, well, I was on board with everything he was doing. The foreign policy, the domestic policy, he says he is our retribution. I am on board, but not if he falsifies business records. That's just a bridge too far. I can't support. I just don't believe there are Americans who think that way.
Yeah, I suppose I mostly agree. And I think I pretty much said as much in that piece that most people who are inclined to vote for Trump will find some rationalization to do so to minimize their discomfort with his felony conviction if he is convicted of a felony. But I don't think that's true of every single person who's saying this. I think some of them actually do mean it. And the inverse is also true. If he were acquitted, if they can't find this other crime, then it would taint all the subsequent prosecutions and convince these voters that he is the target of political prosecution.
Noah, I'm going to say totally wrong on that one too. If Trump gets acquitted, there is not a single critic or skeptic out there. Oh, well, it turns out that guy, the Manhattan DA, didn't know what he was talking about. I guess Trump's a good guy after all.
Never
mind the January 6th stuff. Never mind terminate the he's fine. I'm going to vote for him now.
Our only disagreement is your assertion of not one single. I don't think that's necessarily true, but the vast majority I will concede. Dominic, I want to read you two quotes. First, from the New York Times. Mr. Trump's lawyers want a jury that includes younger black men and white working class men, particularly public employees like police officers, firefighters, and sanitation workers. Those who have had bad experiences with the legal system will also be prized by the defense. Prosecutors, conversely, will probably be looking for more educated voters from Democratic neighborhoods, fishing for those who consume news from sources like MSNBC and who are fond of late-night comedians like Stephen Colbert. A second quote from Donald Trump today at 7:51 a.m. Quote, "My trial is an assault on America." This trial is going to be a microcosm of both parties' theories of the election. Maybe the election is the criminal trial in macro. Either way, Trump's criminal trial will become the proxy fight for 2024. It's the Spanish Civil War of the 2024 election. That's my theory. What do you think?
Well, first of all, I really wish the attorneys all the best in their search for educated liberals in Manhattan. That's going to be tough. but I think the democracy argument that the Biden campaign usually wants to make is also an argument that the Trump campaign wants to make, right? Which is that you may not like the guy. You may not agree with everything that he does. You may think he's a bad person, actually. But this is about democracy. This is about democratic values. And this is about deciding who our leaders are at the ballot box, not in a courtroom, and not in a courtroom that, quite frankly, is being overseen by a biased, politically biased prosecutor. And who knows how politically biased the judge and the jury might be too. But certainly, we know Alvin Bragg is a progressive, hack. These charges are being pursued in the way that they are being pursued because it is Donald Trump and because of his standing as a politician. This is not true of all of the cases against Trump, by the way, but it is true of this one. And so you do have people on both sides that are going to be rationalizing their choice in terms of democracy and democratic values as they see them. And one of the funny things about living in a democratic society is that people have genuinely different views of what it means to live in a democratic society. And that's why we have institutions, checks and balances, a constitution, to mediate those differences and allow government to occur. For one side to say, you know, democracy is on my side, on the other side to say, no, democracy is on my side. The fact that we're still appealing to democracy, despite all of the awfulness of all of this, which is not to be overstated, and I fully agree with everything that Jim said before. But the fact that both sides of this are still appealing to democracy in their arguments is actually maybe slightly encouraging. It kind of shows that there is actually something there that American voters still largely find appealing about living in a democratic society. So I don't know. I'm just trying to find some kind of silver lining here, and I think that might be it.
That's optimistic. Yeah, I like it. Phil, so for all the talk about how Trump and company are hurting themselves with their obsessive relitigation of 2020, I was going through the trial, the jury selection updates yesterday, and it has all this feel of a retrospection on the 2016 election. Prosecutors tried to play the Access Hollywood tape audio, but they were denied, so they could only be read the transcript of the tape, as though anybody's unfamiliar with the Access Hollywood tape or its transcript. There's more to come from the assessment of, you know, Michael Cohen's credibility and what have you. This is all going to be very retrospective in ways that could frame Democrats as particularly myopic, especially if it gets into the relitigation of the effort to pin the blame for Donald Trump's 2016 election on Moscow, which was a fixation of the Democratic left for the better part of 4 years. Do you see that risk as well? What's your take on the initial outset of this trial?
I mean, my view is, like, the bigger picture is that basically we're looking at an election in which, you know, both candidates will have a floor of somewhere between 40% and 45%. It depends on the floor is probably normally closer to 45%. Maybe if RFK Jr. and some of the other third party candidates, you know, take some nibbles here or there, we're talking about, you know, it being like 42%, 43%, and so forth. You'd assume that none of the third party candidates could win an actual state. So from an electoral standpoint, you're looking at, they probably both start off with around 230 electoral votes. And so it's a matter of cobbling together some combination of a few swing states to be able to become president. And right now, the big picture to me is that both sides are doing a lot of stuff to rally up the base and drive up turnout among the base. For the Democratic side, this is, if Trump gets back in, democracy's over. He's going to be Trump on steroids in term two. We're going to have an outright dictatorship. We'll never get rid of Trump again. He's never going to lose power. On the Republican side, it's like they stole 2020. They're going to try to keep stealing elections. This is sort of a corrupt, regime that we need to topple. Trump's the only way to get, you know, to stop this sort of, to push this fascist regime out of power. And then you basically hope that you're among the independents, that the independents see the other guy as worse. Now, Republicans, had they nominated somebody who wasn't Trump, would have the ability to just focus on, Trump on Biden's liabilities, his age, inflation, the crisis in the border, the multiple foreign policy crises from the botched Afghanistan withdrawal, the Mideast in flames, the terrible Russia-Ukraine policy, and so forth. And basically, there's a lot that you could argue against Biden, but because you have Trump, it's sort of neutralized by all of this courtroom drama and so forth. So it's sort of unclear. I think both sides are making mistakes, but both sides primarily are hoping to motivate their base to show up and scare enough independents away from the other guy. It doesn't really seem like we're going to have much of an election where people are going to try to reach out to the middle and so forth. Biden can change his age. Trump is facing trial in multiple jurisdictions. So I think that's kind of where we are. And the lost opportunity, as I say, was to just basically run a campaign where instead of arguing about did Trump fall asleep during jury selection or not, we could be arguing about how Biden's bungled efforts in the Middle East have now brought us to the brink of a major regional war, which he said he was going to prevent. How the border is a complete disaster, how we just had a massive, terrible inflation report. I mean, we had an egregious inflation report that in a normal campaign, you'd see Republicans messaging on, you know, all week. Instead, we're arguing about fake news or not. So,
yeah, I tend to agree with all of that. So, but let's just put a period on this one and we'll get all you guys in on Jim and Mai's argument. So, Jim, exit question for everybody is, will the Bragg case matter in November 2024? Jim, you say no, yeah?
Marginally, if at all.
Marginally, if at all. Phil?
As I said, no. Now that the candidates are Trump versus Biden and not, let's say, a Republican, you know, relative to a Republican who wasn't in trial, I think it's sort of better. So in that sense, you can, it's worse than it would be if you had a so-called generic Republican. So in that sense, you could say it hurts him. But if you're looking at now we're in a world where it's Trump versus Biden, I think it's basically just gets washed in with all of Biden's, you know, massive baggage.
Dominic?
I don't think it'll matter a ton. I think it'll matter slightly more than I understand Jim to be thinking it matters, but still not a ton. But the issue with that is that this is going to be a really close election where it's very possible that, you know, fewer than 100,000 votes in four or five states ends up deciding who the president is. And so if it's going to be that close, this sort of thing, which really isn't going to affect a lot of people's decisions, it could actually contribute to the margin of victory for one candidate or the other. So I do think it's possible.
Yeah, I think it matters. Whatever the outcome of the jury here, if they find Trump guilty, Trump will be a convicted felon, and that's all Joe Biden will talk about. And if Trump is found acquitted, it's all Donald Trump will talk about. So I can't imagine that doesn't matter, margins or otherwise. But with that, let's take a moment to talk to you about our second sponsor of the day, Made In Cookware. If you're considering the pros and cons of different cookware brands, you should know that Made In has more of the pros. Pros like Tom Colicchio, Nancy Silverton, Brooke Williamson, and many other professional chefs who all trust their cooking to Made In Cookware. Fact is, Made In has a long-standing relationship with professional chefs. The company evolved from a 100-year-old kitchen supply business and works with multi-generational makers to craft each piece. They make exactly what demanding chefs are looking for, including a wide selection of curated products from carbon steel to stainless clad, plus plateware, glassware, and more. But perhaps the biggest pro is that Made In is sold online and delivered to your door, all for a fraction of the price of other top brands. If you want to take your cooking to the next level, invest in Made In Cookware. Once you try it, you'll be pro made in, too. Editors listeners get 10% off full-priced items from Made In. For full details, visit madeincookware.com/editors. That's M-A-D-E-I-N cookware.com/editors. So Monday of this week was Tax Day. Today, Tuesday, April 16th, is Tax Freedom Day. It's the 104th day of the calendar year, which represents, on average, the point at which you've earned just enough to satisfy your tax burden, depending on your state. It's a lot worse for me in New Jersey, but it might be okay for you wherever you are in this country. And you can start earning now to improve your lives and further your own economic goals. Dominic, progressives have a pretty complicated relationship with tax time. When they're not in mixed company, when they're just talking to themselves, Tax Day is the most patriotic day in the calendar. It's your time to contribute to all the grand and noble pursuits that we ascribe to the public sector. But when they're appealing to mixed audiences, they emphasize or try to emphasize the outcomes of what we all do together, you know, in government. The word for what we all do together. So they emphasize the communitarianism of it and the perverse joy of being confiscatory. But Joe Biden has an increasingly complex relationship with taxes. His party's advocacy for tax hikes and the tariff schedule he inherited. You have some thoughts on Tax Freedom Day and what it means for our president and his reelection efforts this year.
Well, it would be nice, as we mentioned before, to have a more normal Republican candidate who could talk about popular Republican things, like, for example, reforming the tax code, making it simpler, reducing the burden on people and on businesses. But instead, we have Donald Trump, who is promising to both cut and raise taxes. He says he wants to cut taxes even more than he cut them in the 2017 tax cut bill, which usually gets called Trump tax cuts, but is probably more accurately Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, Kevin Brady tax cuts. But regardless, he signed it. He gets the credit. He wants to do that. But on the other hand, he wants to raise tariffs. He's been talking about a 10% tariff on all imports. And then he's been sort of riffing on 100% tariffs on automobiles, certain higher tariffs on other specific products, whatever he sort of feels. And that is going to be a tax increase on Americans. Probably won't be directly in the sense that, you know, you don't file an income tax return to pay tariffs, but it shows up in higher prices, which again is something that we should be sticking to Biden because of inflation. But you've got Trump that's promising to essentially raise prices through tariffs. So we're looking at an election actually where it's very possible that the Democrat will be running to the right of the Republican on the issue of taxation. Biden will probably be the one who is talking about cutting taxes on the middle class or reducing taxes on the middle class, and he'll be pointing to Donald Trump and saying he wants to raise your taxes. Now, this is somewhat disingenuous because Biden, of course, does want to raise taxes. His budget had various tax increases in it. If he gets reelected, he will, I'm sure, be pushing for those coming up. But he will have a point on the tariffs. He will have a point on what Trump wants to do to the United States international trade. And look, about half of U.S. imports are used in the production of goods in the United States. And so the idea that we can just sort of isolate ourselves off from the rest of the world, pay slightly higher prices for some things, and then bring jobs back. It's actually going to do more of the opposite because those inputs are going to be more expensive. That means firms might have to lay off workers. They're certainly not going to be able to hire more workers in order to make the products that they need because they will need to find more expensive sourcing options here in the United States. And so, we're going to have, like I said, we could very well have an election where the Democrat is running, at least rhetorically, to the right of the Republican on taxes. And we haven't seen that in a very long time in the U.S.
Honestly, I've been waiting for it. If this great realignment that everybody talks about is real, we should see it in policy advocacy, not just from Republicans, but from Democrats. So right now we have a Democratic Party that is increasingly beholden to degree holders in the suburbs who traditionally make up the backbone of what would be a fiscally conservative constituency. But the Democratic Party still has this vestigial attachment to great society liberalism. And now we have Republicans who aspire to great society liberalism in order to attract those voters to their coalition. So conservatives get the worst of both worlds. Phil, Dominic mentioned it. We should coin it now. We're coming up on the Trump tax cut cliff. Mm-hmm. Pretty soon, Congress is going to have to decide what to do with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. And you're not especially sanguine about it, as I understand it.
Well, what I find interesting about this is that the Trump tax cuts, for those that remember, basically is part of the how they were able to get it passed. They had to make the numbers add up. They basically had to make the individual tax provisions temporary so that the score, the cost of the bill as evaluated by the CBO would be less and fit through the limits they had set over the 10-year time horizon. They made the corporate tax cuts permanent with the thought that Democrats would allow corporate tax cuts to expire without breaking a sweat, but that the individual tax cuts would be harder to roll back. Now, what I find interesting is that the expiration, which the individual tax cuts are supposed to expire, if nothing is done, at the end of 2025. So this is going to be a major crisis that's going to happen within the first year of whoever's elected that not many people are talking about. Now, on the Democratic side, the difficulty of saying we're just going to get rid of it is that doing so would represent a massive tax increase on many middle-class families. Around 90% of people now take the supersized standard deduction, which is a lot simpler than itemizing. And this would do away with that, and we'd revert back to a system in which there was a lower standard deduction. It would be cut in half, and you'd have to more and more people going through the hassle of itemizing. That would disproportionately affect people who are middle class or lower income, as would increasing, bringing back the deduction for state and local taxes, mortgage interest deduction on mortgages over $750,000, which would primarily benefit the well-off. So there are a lot of class issues that are created by Democrats by just saying, we're going to get rid of it. But for Republicans, it's kind of interesting either, because even though these were the Trump tax cuts and they were the crowning achievement of his presidency, the actual policy was dominated by the old Republican Party. The nucleus of the bill was created by Dave Camp, who had been the Ways and Means chairman during the second term of Obama. He spent years generating a lot of this policy. He retired, and then it was really ushered through by Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell. Paul Ryan's out of the way. Mitch McConnell is on his way out. Now you have all of these new Republicans and people like J.D. Vance and Josh Hawley and so forth having a lot of anti-corporate rhetoric and speaking of taxes in a much different way. And I don't know if the tax cut as it's written was written by the sort of old guard of the Republican Party would really write a similar tax bill now. And so I'm kind of curious about how even the modern Republican Party would want to address this. Maybe they don't want to just simply fight to renew everything as is. Maybe they want to claw back some of the corporate tax cuts against woke corporations and instead use some of that money to provide more relief for families. I don't, you know, they've been silent. You know, we're arguing about Trump trials, so we're not really discussing these issues. But it sort of fascinates me how that pans out. But it is going to be, you know, it's something that's going to dominate the first year of whoever is elected next.
Yeah, Jim, Phil mentioned state and local taxes. And, you know, we talk a lot about federal taxes, but it's the local stuff that is really a killer. At least it is for me and probably a lot of others in the Northeast and the Mid-Atlantic. Property taxes are spiking all over because things are getting more expensive for everyone, including local governments. Combine that with high interest rates, which make borrowing much more expensive, and the fact that the housing market somehow has not cooled and inventory remains low, prices remain high. Dissatisfaction in particular with local conditions is probably as high as it is with federal conditions. Yeah.
Yeah. So before I dive into the taxes, we here in the Garrity household filed our taxes just a couple of days before the deadline. And I don't know about you guys, but if there was the option of taking an additional deduction, but in order to qualify, an IRS agent had to come to your front door and they would be allowed to kick you in the nads as hard as they wanted, I would still take that deduction. I would still take that deal because you're going to feel like that when this process is done anyway. It's basically, you can either metaphorically get kicked in the nads or you can literally get kicked in the nads. And if it'll kick a little bit off a little bit off my tax bill, I'll take that one. One of the things that prompted me to start thinking about this was a Wall Street Journal front page article talking about the cost of owning a home. And basically, never mind this year, 2022 analysis by Fannie Mae. Non-mortgage costs, including property taxes, now make up more than half of homeowners' overall costs. You think about, you know, can I afford a house? If I wanted to move there, what would I need? Most people do the math in their head and calculate how much would the mortgage be. And yes, that's a big chunk of it, but that's not all of it. And in fact, usually once you add up property taxes, maintenance, utilities, and home insurance, God help you if you're one of these states where the insurance companies are fleeing, including a bunch of the South, because of hurricane damage and things like that. Prices go up. But you mentioned state and local taxes, and I want to thank Fairfax County for believing that my house is suddenly way more valuable than it was last year. It's understandable that when the Biden administration broke the seventh seal and unleashed inflation upon America, there's a reason most economists talk about high inflation like it's crossing the streams in Ghostbusters, and it's the sort of thing you should never do, because once you create this problem, it snowballs and it keeps having this effect. And so we've had two things. One is that everything your local government wants to buy has gotten more expensive over the last couple of years. Everything from the paper for the schools, for asphalt, for the roads, everything they need to do has gotten more expensive. And oh, by the way, there are a bunch of reasons to be skeptical of the giant amount of infrastructure spending that Biden had gone through in his first couple of years. But let's keep in mind, by saying to every state and locality, you know, here's money, go do some infrastructure projects. Well, it made sure that every single state and locality was looking to buy construction equipment, cement, asphalt, rebar, all the stuff that they need to build all these highway interchanges and new roads and bridges and all that stuff. They're all trying to buy it at the same time. What happens when demand goes up? Prices go up. So the process of completing all of these projects becomes a lot more expensive. So I have a certain amount of sympathy for local governments in that their cost of business has gone up dramatically than it did a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. Thanks, Biden administration. On the other hand, you're seeing it in your property taxes. You're seeing it in everything else that you have to of the costs associated with. But like, none of these things are things you can really, you can try to shop around for homeowners insurance, but you're not going to find dramatically different rates in most cases. Your property taxes, there's no way to get out of those. Maintenance, you can try to, like, if you cut corners there, you're going to end up paying the price sooner or later. Most of these things, utilities, you don't really have many options in that. So like, all of these things are baked in the cake. And then people will walk around. So many Democrats will say, God, the unemployment rate is so low. Why aren't Americans more, you know, happier about the economy? Why aren't they giving Biden more credit? Because they can't afford anything anymore. And my only suspicion is the people who are saying these things are so wealthy that they no longer bother to worry about these sorts of things. And, you know, they're well beyond even the Henry level, which means, you know, high earner, not rich yet.
Well, the things that Jim just said about infrastructure and about local governments actually compound the things that Phil just said about 2025 and make it worse, because that is part of the fiscal cliff that we're running into in 2025 as well. During COVID, state and local governments got a bunch of extra aid from the federal government. That aid is running out because it was a one-time thing. But a lot of them spent it all, or spent big chunks of it anyway. And that's especially true in blue states, by the way, more so than red states. And so they're going to be coming back to Congress and asking for more. And they're going to be making very similar arguments to the argument that Jim just made. And the argument Jim just made is true. They do have higher costs for a lot of the things that they were doing before. And so they're going to come to Congress and say, excuse me, we remember that money you gave us before? Yeah, we need some more. And contractors for infrastructure projects are going to be saying the same thing because, as Jim said, when you dump a bunch of money into one sector of the economy, you get inflation in that sector. And the price of a lot of these projects is going to be higher than was initially projected. And a bunch of contract authority under the infrastructure bill from 2021 also runs out around 2025. And so they're going to be coming back to Congress and saying, hey, remember those projects that we started and didn't finish yet? Yeah, we're going to need some more money for those. It's all made worse by the fact that we have no slack in the labor market either. And so all of the workers that are being used on those jobs are being pulled off of other more productive jobs elsewhere in the economy because there's not a bunch of unemployed people out there looking for work. And so that drives up wages, drives up labor costs as well. And so they're going to come to Congress and say, hey, we need more money to finish these things. All that's going to be happening at the same time that we're talking about extending the tax cuts and extending the subsidies for Obamacare, which, you know, there was an income limit on those that was also removed by Democrats in the American Rescue Plan Act. They're going to want to extend that too. All of that money is going to be coming down at the same time, right in the first year or two of the next president's term, whoever that is. And you know, you'd think this would be something that would be talked about on the campaigns, but again, we have to talk about fake news.
You heard it here first, editors, listeners. As bad as everything is now, it's only going to get worse. How's that? Take that, commentary podcast. How's that for crushing morosity? Let's take a moment briefly to do a quick plug for NR Plus, our digital subscription service. It's your way around our metered paywall and your way to see 90% fewer ads when you sign up and log in. NR Plus subscribers are invited to comment on articles and blog posts, and they get invites to our exclusive calls and events with our writers and editors, as well as conservative newsmakers. It's a great deal all around. But most importantly, NR Plus is a crucial way for you to support our valuable journalism. If you're not already a member, please consider joining tens of thousands of your fellow National Review readers by becoming a member of NR Plus today. Let's move on to a couple of other things. Jim, you're doing a, you'll have to walk me through this. It's a mock NFL draft. Explain it to me.
That's all right. Happy mock draft season to all those who celebrate. If you feel like the Christmas decorations in Kmart or your local grocery store or Target or something like that started early, let's face it, you know, a lot of sports sites will start their mock drafts, if not the day after the Super Bowl, sometimes after the day after the regular season, and they won't even wait for the rest of the playoffs to be finished. If you're a New York Jets fan, as Phil and I are, this is one of the most exciting times of the year. You actually get to have a little bit of hope and optimism because the Jets are always picking somewhere in the top 10 or so. And on the one hand, you know, the first couple of weeks I'll get kind of excited because for those who don't know, the NFL, players come out of college and they make a very big do. Usually it's around the middle of April. I feel like it got pushed back to late April. They pick some city. They used to do it at Radio City Music Hall, and teams, you know, select who they want. The worst team in the league usually gets to go first. The Super Bowl winner gets to go last. Teams can trade. Team can move up. And you know what's great is you get to see these young guys who've been stars in college. They're there wearing the fanciest suit. Usually they're there with their mama. And they get to go down, they get to, you know, bear hug the commissioner, and you know that a young life of hard work is paying off. They're going to make $1 million or more the following year. Some of these guys are going to go on to be huge stars. Some of them are going to go on to be, you know, giant busts, and you know, you're going to forget about their name and whatever happened to that guy, and why couldn't he break into the starting lineup? I like draft season. I like when we get to see Mel Kiper Jr. on our screens, and then they put him back into cryo freeze until the next draft season over at ESPN. But I got to admit, it does get on a little bit long. It is starting to drag on. I think we are now in our fourth month of draft season. It is next Thursday. I will not be here for a chunk of next week. So this is my last chance to tell you, I think the Jets, about my suspicion is they're going to take the tight end Bowers. I'd really prefer to see them take a wide receiver or one of the offensive linemen. Wouldn't even mind trading up to get Marvin Harrison Jr. They're probably not going to do that sort of thing. But if they do, you heard it here first.
Speaking of drafts, Dominic, you're following Caitlin Clark mania and her accession to the WNBA.
Yeah, Noah. You know, the women's basketball tournament in the NCAA this year was that the championship game was watched by more people than the men's championship game was. And deservedly so, I would say. The women's championship game was a much better, more entertaining basketball game than the men's championship was. It was kind of a snooze because UConn was just better and they just won. But yeah, Caitlin Clark is one of the best women's basketball players ever. She's one of the best college players, hands down, ever. And she was drafted first in the WNBA draft, and her contract is going to be for about $75,000 a year. And obviously, that is nothing compared to what NBA players make if they're really, really good. And so, this is a lot of people saying, "Oh, this is unfair." Or whatever. There's two problems with that. The first problem is, if you want Caitlin Clark to be paid more, if you want WNBA players to be paid more, you can go to WNBA games and watch WNBA on TV and do things that we would normally do to support a sports league. It's just the truth that they have nowhere near as many fans as the NBA does. I mean, the NBA not only has tons of fans in the United States, they have fans all over the world who pay lots of money for jerseys and for tickets and all the rest of this stuff. And so that money goes back to the players. That's just not true in the WNBA. But the second point is the market is finding a way to compensate Caitlin Clark anyway, because she is going to make millions in endorsement deals. You know, with whatever shoe brand she ends up signing with, that's very lucrative for them. They want to be the official shoe of Caitlin Clark. And, you know, she has lots of fans, especially among younger girls who are growing up and want to be basketball players. So it's a very interesting story sort of about how the money aligns with the hype around it. And I wish her all the best. You know, like I said, it was a great NCAA tournament. Lots of fun to watch, and it'll be interesting to see where it goes as she turns pro.
Phil, you're in New York City right now, but you have returned to a city that has left you behind.
Yeah. a lot of people talk about the crime, the filth, the garbage in New York, but I have to say, I was walking around here yesterday and I saw a poster for a rainbow bagel with M&M cream cheese filling. It's just sort of a monstrosity. Like, is New York even a city anymore? Like, at long last, do they not have any sense of decency? And I just feel like it's another way in which Instagram and social media has kind of ruined the world, because it's incentivized restaurants to just create culinary monstrosities that they hope will go viral on social media. And guilty, I did tweet it out, my contempt. So maybe I fell into their trap, their marketing.
And now it's on a podcast too.
Yeah, exactly.
It's blowing up. I had some opportunity to actually watch some TV because I was traveling down to DC over the weekend to do Chris Steigerwald's show on News Nation, which I'm grateful for. So I was treating myself to binge watching the new show on Amazon Prime, Fallout. And I heartily recommend it. This is based on a video game that I used to play when I was a young boy in the early 1990s, mid-1990s. There was a strategy game called Fallout. They resurrected the series in 2008, a couple of installations of it. And it's a very good game, and it's a really good show that's probably as close, as faithful an interpretation as the game as The Last of Us was on HBO. The Last of Us was like beat by beat. Even the camera shots were the same as in the game. But this one is a bit of a reinterpretation, but a very enjoyable one. It's set in a post-nuclear apocalyptic landscape, but it's kind of retro-futurist. It's what the future would have looked like based in an interpretation of it from the 1950s. And it's very campy, super violent, but almost has this childlike interpretation of this Hobbesian landscape. It's a really interesting juxtaposition. The performances are very enjoyable. If you're interested in that sort of thing, go check it out. But now it's time for our editor's picks. Phil, what's your pick?
I'm going to pick a piece by our absent leader, Rich. Today he has a piece, The Anti-Israel Delusion. And basically he highlights a lot of other conflicts around the world in which there's actually a much stronger case to be made in terms of the humanitarian crisis that's being driven by hostile actors and not people who are defending themselves from a horrific attack. I'm talking about places, you know, he mentions places like the Sudanese Civil War and the conflict in Yemen and other theaters. So it's well worth your time.
Very good piece. One that I was going to pick as well, but I have another one in store. Jim, what's your pick?
So I'm going to go with the House editorial, The Failed Experiment with Ending Standardized Testing. Look, I don't know if any of us really love this SAT, but it has its place. It has its value. It is kind of, there's something good about giving the same test to all kinds of students all across the country. It's one where, you know, there's no teacher favorability. There's no, it's either, you know, you have your Scantron sheet. I'm dating myself here, but you know, you have your multiple choice. You get to see how everybody's doing and you get to see, okay, how did all these students do? And there's a good chance you will spot some student, a diamond in the rough. Maybe the grades aren't that great. Maybe the school's not that great. Maybe they got lousy teachers, whatever it is, they have some potential there. They have some talent there. And, you know, for a long time, it was almost standard at every, you know, no pun intended, for every single institute of higher education. And then there was this panic about the use of the SAT and all kinds of schools started, oh, particularly the Ivy Leagues, oh, we're not going to use this anymore. Well, look, you know, Harvard has announced that it's reversing its standardizing testing optional policy. Dartmouth did the same. Yale did the same. It looks like there is a, you know, rather accelerating, you know, reversal in the other direction. The editors spike the football, and I think you should do that every chance you get in life.
Dominic, what's your piece?
We talk a lot about how, you know, we talked on this podcast about how Republicans at the national level don't really seem to care about policy. They're giving up on sort of conservative economic values that we know work, that we know are effective. But if you look back at the state level, actually, a lot of Republicans are still doing great stuff, and we have a piece up today from Michael Lucci called The Michigan-Ohio Economic Rivalry Shifts in the Buckeye State's Favor. It's talking about how Ohio, under Republican leadership, both in under Governor Mike DeWine and then the legislature there, but going back even to when John Kasich was governor, they've done a lot of really good free market reforms there and are showing themselves to be a much better environment for investment, for economic growth than Michigan, which is going the other way under Democratic leadership with, you know, more powerful unions, with more state intervention in the economy. And Ohio, right across the border, is showing that the sort of so-called old Republican approach to economic policy still works.
And I'm going to put in a good word for Andy McCarthy's latest, the legal doctrine that may be Trump's best defense in Bragg's hush money case. He is an invaluable resource all the time, but especially now with Donald Trump in the dock. And he outlines in this piece, if the jury follows the letter of the law, why he thinks it's going to be pretty difficult for them to find the second charge that Bragg needs them to find. That's going to do it for us. You've been listening to a National Review podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this show without written and express permission of National Review magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Phil. Thank you, Dominic. And thank you to the absent Rich Lowry. Thank you also to our advertisers, Patriot Voices and Made In. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors, and we'll see you next time.